Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Streamed and Screamed, an entertainment podcast about movies and TV from Lee Enterprises. I'm Terry Lipschitz, managing editor of the National Newsroom at Lee and co-host of the program, Bruce Miller, editor of the Sioux City Journal, a longtime entertainment reporter. And we had an action-packed weekend with a big movie that another, it's not quite at the level of, like, you know, Deadpool and Wolverine in terms of money, but it took the box office. And these R-rated movies don't always rake in a ton of money.
You know, it reminded me of the past. It really did. This was when summer movies were kind of fun and you just kind of got absorbed into it. You didn't really need to know anything. Alien Romulus.
Yes. We both saw it this weekend, not together, but separately. What were your thoughts of this one?
You know what? I loved the idea that it references earlier films, even though they say, you know, this is not related. It's not, you don't have to see the other ones to know this one. You know, all that kind of disclaimer stuff so that then people don't stay away from the film. But it did have Easter eggs, if you will, that reference the earlier films. And I thought it was a great way to introduce AI into the world because there's a character that recurs from one of the early films and he's not around anymore.
Yeah. The actor had died. I agree with you here too. What's it like Alien? I love the franchise, but it's not like for me, Star Wars is one where I'll like every once in a while, I'll just throw on Empire Strikes Back or Return of the Jedi or whatever. Right. With Alien, I don't remember the last time I saw the original one. You know, I remember Alien Resurrection came out in the late 90s and I saw it. And then I probably haven't seen it since the late 1990s. So there's a lot of these movies where it's like, ooh, Alien movie, got to see it. I'll see it. And then I don't go back to it. So, you know, I saw Prometheus. I saw Covenant when it came out a few years ago. I haven't seen it since. So with a lot of these things, it's kind of back of the mind. So when I went to see Romulus, I had forgotten a lot of things. And so I was going into it thinking like, okay, if I was a moviegoer who had never seen this franchise, would this movie hold up? And it absolutely does because you don't need that prior knowledge. It's completely unnecessary. You could just watch this movie and if you like it, decide, okay, I'll go back and watch the others. You could be like, yeah, it's, you know, it's good. I've no interest in seeing anything else. And you'd be totally fine. It's the perfect film where it has those callbacks to the original. It brings in some references to the two newer movies, like that black goo kind of thing, where those were introduced in the two newer prequels that Ridley Scott had done. But at the same time, it stands on its own. And it kind of, at the end, sets up the possibility that we could do more, that we could spin the same story forward and have another, or it could just be one and done and just be a standalone film. So it's like everything about it to me was perfect. It had its, you know, they call these movies horror movies. I don't see it as a horror movie. I see it as more like a sci-fi thriller. Like it's not like, to me, I don't like horror movies that are just these gory, gross, disturbing type of things. This is just, it's a monster movie, which I think is a little bit different than a traditional horror movie, if that makes sense. Like you have, it's just, you're watching it and then you're like jumping in your seat because it kind of freaks you out. But it's not this like, you know, there's moments where you got aliens busting out of your chest and everything, but it's not the gross gore fest of some of these slasher type of movies. It's a different, in my mind at least, it's a little bit of a different, it's just more of a sci-fi thriller, edge of your seat, intense.
Yeah, I like the idea that there are films that come chronologically after this, that if I wanted to go and watch and say, well, what really happened to all of that stuff? I'd know where to go. I could find that and I would have to wait for 5 years for some director to kind of dream it up what it might be. So that's what's good about this kind of screwy timeline they've got that they're working with. But like you, there are two characters that make it through to the end of this. And I'm not saying that that's a spoiler or anything, but you could see where they could easily launch into another phase of the whole thing. And I'd like to see that. I would be very interested in what happens there. What I found fascinating about this is they have a character who is an android who changes in the course of time, not necessarily in terms of temperament, because they're not supposed to have that kind of feeling. He is like kind of simple in the beginning when you first meet him, and then he becomes very intelligent. And it's like, it's whatever the chip is or the thing that they stick in his neck. I love that. Isn't that us on a daily basis?
Right.
You know, depending on what program we're in or whatever we're doing, we could be just brilliant or we could be really simple and stupid.
Yeah. I think what worked for this also is with Ridley Scott, he didn't direct this one. So he directed the original, the 1979 film. He was largely, I think, uninvolved with all of the sequels after it. James Cameron did the second one. I don't think he was a producer on any of the other movies. I think it was just other people kind of took the story and moved it forward. But he came back and did Prometheus and then Alien Covenant. So he directed those two. With this one, he just served as kind of, you know, producer, executive producer, whichever it was. So he wasn't the director of it, but he gave notes. I even saw an interview with him where, you know, the director of this film, he did it. And then pulled Ridley Scott in and said, like, you know, watch it and let me know. And Ridley Scott gave him notes and said, you know, yeah, it works here. You might want to change this here. And so he was involved with it and it kind of kept his vision going, but he was also able to hand it off to somebody else. It still felt like to me, it felt very much like the original because it had that dark, like it's always dark. There's only one scene that I could think of, you know, when they're on the bridge of the ship where it actually, everything was turned on and it was bright. It was otherwise, it had that same dark, creepy feel to the original with Sigourney Weaver.
If you were at home, you'd go try to turn on the brightness and get it a little lighter so you could see what's going on in there. And I noticed so much of it was with lighting. You know, whenever there was some kind of warning thing, the lights would be flashing. And those things create that mood in you that makes you kind of nervous and react accordingly. Now, in any of these kind of situations, I would be the first one dead. I realized that because I'm not going to do all this kind of jumping and trying to get away from whatever is out there. I'm not going to try and make it through a door before the door closes. I'd be like, okay, bye, see ya, I'm out of here, we're good. But it's fascinating to see those who have that kind of will, and you think, well, they got to last. They're not going to get bounced right away. But there also is a point in this movie where a character looks like this character is still alive or still has life. And I would have left that person alone. I would have just said, sorry, I am not helping you. I'm out of here. Because you know darn well there's an alien somewhere.
Right, right. And I think it was referenced. There was an early, before they went up into space, they're on that mining colony, and they were talking about how one of the androids had made a decision in the mine that, you know, because they're supposed to protect life, but they kind of killed somebody. But it was, you know, they sacrificed 3 people to save 10 kind of thing. So it sort of comes back in the theme where we as humans have this emotional attachment of trying to help everyone, where there's a coldness to an artificial being who's just using, you know, numbers basically to make a decision. I'm running the odds here in my computer brain, and you're not going to survive, so we're just going to sacrifice that person for, you know, it goes Star Trek 3, or 2, when like the good of the many outweighs the good of the one, right? So with Spock, that's kind of what it is.
Look at it in some kind of corporate places where, you know, there's an accident and it's like, well, but then we saved, you know, is that really the thinking that we should have for all this? We should save everybody. I knew it was trouble when the girl tried to get PTO and she couldn't get the time off. She didn't have it earned or something. Uh-oh, this company is trouble.
You know, you got to respect those quotas. let them take a vacation. Come on.
Let them have a vacation to go to some old garbage dump up in the sky somewhere. It all looks so bleak in the future. You go, I'm not living there. This is not good. But I enjoyed it. I thought it was lots of fun. And it was one that I'm glad I had popcorn at the movie. Yeah. Well, okay, we're talking about horror films, and I also saw one that's coming up next week on Netflix.
Okay.
It's called The Deliverance. Now, this is not Deliverance, the... it isn't
that. No banjos, no.
It's now, and you think, okay, Glenn Close, all right, you're getting a picture. And then Andra Day, who was an Oscar nominee, is in it. They play mother and daughter. Okay. They're living in this house that doesn't seem that bad. But suddenly the house, there's something wicked this way comes. And it starts affecting Andra's kids. And they start, like, one tries to hold the other one down under the bath water longer than he should. And then there's one climbing the walls. And I mean, it's a lot of stuff. And you think, maybe the house is haunted. And then the mother says, well, if you weren't doing this, this, and this, those kids wouldn't be so screwed up. And maybe you need to find religion. And so then it gets into this whole context of, is there a need for an exorcist around here?
Okay.
But they don't go to an exorcist. They go to somebody who helps with what they call the deliverance.
Oh.
And this is a way of, I guess, kind of soaking it out of the house. But it's based on a real story.
It's sort of like another run at the Amityville horrors.
Or yes, and any of those ones with the haunted house. And people who have lived in the house since say that there are still creepy things that happen.
Well, I don't get that. How do haunted houses get sold? And why do people move into them?
Isn't that something you have to disclaim?
Right? You would think.
I would say, why did the last person leave this house? And
right.
I'm always one to ask about, was there a death in this house? You know? I'm not having that. I'm not having somebody haunt the house just because.
Yeah. Why are the walls bleeding? You know?
Right. But what is that stain on the floor? Right. Looks vaguely like a body outline.
The shock outline of the...
That starts next week on Netflix. And it has been out on the movie circuit for the last week. And I'm sure they're trying to get some attention. Lee Daniels directs. And it does have a little tish of that Precious. You know, if you ever saw Precious, Monique is in it. She plays a social worker. You don't recognize her at all. She's not like the mean mother she played in that. But there are people you recognize. And you think poor Andra Day was going through hell making this thing because they ever doing a lot of stuff.
When you get kind of like those big names to do a horror, because horror, horror is the movie you do before you get famous. You know, it's like, you kind of like Jamie Lee Curtis was younger and she did Halloween. And then, I mean, I know she went back and did more of them after the fact, but it's kind of like that thing you do at the beginning of your career and then you establish yourself and then you're too big for horror. But you see, Glenn Close is doing it. And then did you see also with an Alien, that really creepy looking movie, Heretic with Hugh Grant? Like, wait, is that Hugh Grant doing, is this a horror movie or is it just a really crazy, like Silence of the Lambie type of thing, suspense?
It's like Bette Davis and Joan Crawford. When they got toward the twilight years, they started doing these all the time. You think, why? You don't need to do this. Well, either they like to work or this is all they're getting offered.
But Hugh Grant, I mean, he's still big. He was just in that Willy Wonka movie. It's an Oompa Loompa.
Maybe it's better than you think.
Maybe he's just trying to have some fun, branch out and just do. He like, I moved past the horror movies too early, and now I want to go back and do them,
Some of them say that they've got either like previous wives they've got to pay off, or they've got child support, or there's some reason for them to financially need the movie. So that could be it too. Or it's a good script.
Maybe it's just fun. They read the script and be like, yeah, I'll do that. That just, yes, it's not what I would normally do, but.
Some could work 2 days and they're top billed. So you never know, I always love those movies where they had this big star in it and then they're dead before the credits start rolling at the beginning. Yeah, so that's a different kind of thing. But, we talk about the Alien movie and Ridley Scott is considered a pretty big factor. This December, he has Gladiator 2 coming out, and he's like, 80 something? And still, he's like Clint was, still making movies later in life, and they're still good films. And, PBS has this series called American Masters, and they point out people who are, if you will, geniuses in their fields.
Right.
And they've done a thing on Walt Disney. They've done, you know, various and sundry people. And Ridley Scott would be one I would easily consider would fall into that category. Now, next week, they are focusing on Blake Edwards. And maybe Blake Edwards doesn't really ring a bell for most people, but he was married to Julie Andrews. And you go, oh, yeah, I remember that she had a husband who was a director. But he did a lot of really big films. He did Breakfast at Tiffany's, Days of Wine and Roses, Victor Victoria, SOB 10.
Pink Panther,
yes. So there are all these kind of very time-specific films. I don't know that all of them age well. When you watch them now on the Classics channel, you go, there's a problem with that. But at the time, they were very important. And they were things that you would plan to go see. Like when Sound of Music was coming out, that was an event film. Pink Panther was the same way. So was Victor Victoria was a huge, huge musical version of a story that had gone back for years. And it was Julie Andrews trying to do something different. You know, Blake always wanted to get Julie out of that kind of Mary Poppins mode. And he would suggest things. Like, I believe in SOB, she has a topless scene. And it was like, do we want to see Julie Andrews like this? You know, and so then he suggested Victor Victoria. And that was about a woman pretending to be a man, pretending to be a woman. And this predates a lot of transsexual talk or any of that kind of stuff in the years that have happened since. This was 1980, like two, and huge movie. And she was nominated for Best Actress, and also nominated for Best Supporting Actress was Leslie Ann Warren. Now, Leslie Ann Warren is probably somebody that you might remember if you do from being in Cinderella. She was on TV. They did these live musical versions of things, and she was always known as Cinderella. And then she worked in a lot of Disney films. She did The Happiest Millionaire, and she did the one and only original Genuine Family Band. And she worked with Walt. And she said Walt Disney was incredible. But she also worked with Blake Edwards. And she said these were two geniuses. I could tell right away that these were people who knew what they were doing and had a different way of dealing with actors. And I got a chance to talk with Leslie Ann. And if you will, we've got a little bit of the interview, and you get a chance to hear her talk about them and what that all was about, especially how she got into Victor Victoria.
All right. So here's your interview with Leslie Ann Warren.
I look at your career, and you can easily see there are days or times when you take a veer. What prompts those kinds of things? Like, certainly you could have been a Disney person forever, but what changes in your mind? What is the thing that does that?
I wanted to play different women with different issues, whether it was comedic or dramatic. It was really important to me as an actress, even a young baby actress, to be able to understand and illuminate the human condition, you know, women's human condition through my work. So, for instance, I started on Broadway in 110 in the Shade playing this sort of town flirty, sexy, funny girl, and went directly from that to Cinderella, which was, you know, the fairy princess of all time. So I always wanted to attempt to find different avenues of expression through my work.
Do others go along with that idea? Do they say, oh, no, you shouldn't be doing this. This is not...
Yeah. I did a movie called Choose Me. I don't know if you know it. It's an independent movie. And it was coming on the heels of Victor Victoria. So Victor Victoria was this giant movie. And this was a very small independent movie with Alan Rudolph directing. But I loved it. And I loved the character. And I was very anxious to work with Alan Rudolph. And my agent at the time didn't want me to do it. He said, you need to go to something big. You need to do this and this, you know. And so... vice versa, they wanted me to do this big miniseries with Robert Wagner and Angie Dickinson and all these people called Pearl, and about Pearl Harbor. And it was a big, big money day and, right, you know, all that. And I didn't want to do it. And he really pushed me to do it. So I did it. And I was proud of it and happy that I did it. So, yes, that those choices are sometimes, you know.
So when you look back in your career now, do you say, yep, I was right to do it the way I did it?
Yes. And of course, I have a few things that I would have done differently. I reached a point with the TV movies that I was doing in the 80s where I just said, I don't want to do it anymore. I want to do movies. I want to do movies. And nobody wanted me to do that because I was making really wonderful money for all of them. And, you know, they said, we can get you your own production deal. You can, you know, produce your own television movies. We can, you know, and I said, no, I don't want to do them anymore. I want to do movies. And right after that, I got Victor Victoria. At times, I think I did things out of financial fear.
Sure.
You know, whatever it would be. And I probably wouldn't make those same choices today.
Sure. Sure. So do you look back and say, I'm really proud of what I've done?
100,000%.
Good.
I'm so proud.
So how did you get an audition for Victor Victoria?
My agent, who was Ron Meyer at the time, he was the president of CAA, and he was my agent for about 14 years, and he called me on the phone and said, you need to go meet Blake, and I'm sure that he had bitched me to Blake. And I said, I can't go, because my hair's in braids, and I've got a baseball cap on, and I don't want to meet him this way. And he said, no, he's leaving for London tomorrow. You've got to go and meet him. And I went and met him, and he didn't ask me to read or really didn't discuss the part very much. We just kind of laughed and talked about Cinderella, that both Julie and I had done Cinderella. And, you know, and then he told me he had seen Portrait of a Stripper, this television show I had done, and that he knew that I danced and had that kind of character in me. And then in the meeting, he just said, do you want to do this part? And I hadn't read it. But I was such a gigantic Blake Edwards fan that I said, really, what I said in the panel, I would do anything you want me to do. And then I went home and read it, and I was
so
ecstatic.
When you started putting it together, mm-hmm. then do you say, I've got to do a voice with this? I've got to do, or
no,
where do all those little
choices
details come
from?
In? Yeah.
Yeah. I work on creating a backstory. You know, if the backstory isn't in the script, then I work on creating one. So with my coach, we decided that she was, as a young girl, she was working in the Five and Dime, Woolworths, and she would read movie magazines, and her favorite was Jean Harlow. So I copied Jean Harlow's makeup and literally copied it in with the heart and, you know, all of it. And then she lived on the Lower East Side, we decided, and so she had that accent. And then that she lived in a family of 14 and had to yell all the time to get heard and had to be aggressive. And, you know, so slowly I put these pieces of her character together so that I would have a real human being that I was playing.
She's reminding me of Gene Hagen in Singing in the Rain. I'm sorry
That's okay.
Because I loved Lena Lamott. I thought just a really cool, and that it seemed like such a giant leap for you. That wasn't
it
like
was.
The characters that we have ever seen you as.
Ever or myself. I mean, I don't know where I got the courage to put this together in my bedroom. He sent his wig maker and his costume designer to my house from England. And we sort of sat and put this all together visually, not the actual costumes, but talked about it and, you know, designed it. And when I got to England for the very big hair and makeup tests, because it was done on a big screen, and you know, I was sure, he would either love it or I would get fired, because it was because I didn't walk in with that character in to meet him. I was Leslie, and he loved it.
Isn't that weird how they would see something in you that?
I think it's part of his genius. Honestly, I do. I think his capacity to envision what someone was capable of without ever having seen it before is kind of a, you know, part of his brilliance.
Then when they did the Broadway version, mm-hmm. did they come to you and say, do you want to come back and
they
do
did.
It again?
They did. And I was reluctant to do that. I was also semi-committed to another Broadway show called Dream that it was all Johnny Mercer's music. But I talked to Blake about it, and I felt like I had done her the best way I could possibly do her. And I personally didn't want to diminish that.
But, yeah, no.
You know, I just didn't want to diminish it. So, and I was partially committed at that time to Dream. So I had a good out.
This is meant to be, and this is meant to be.
Yeah, I
it
think so.
It doesn't have to be. Mm-hmm. I'll do it forever.
Yeah.
Did you save anything from the movie? Are are you not a saber where you go, oh, and I want to have that costume?
Well, you know, a lot of, they won't because these costumes were brilliantly designed on you. They were built, they call it built, you know, on the actor. So I didn't get to keep anything from that except, you know, the cigarette holder.
Uh-huh.
You know?
So you do have that.
I do have that, well, yeah.
It's weird.
And I had the crown from Cinderella. So
do
that's
you really?
Lovely. Yeah.
How did you get that?
Well, this is a short story, but my husband and I read in some newspaper or something, the woman that the costume designer, Whitaker, he had given the crown to a dear friend of his in Virginia. She kept it in her antique store. She kept it in the front of the store, and all the little girls would come in, want to try it on, whatever. And then she posted, it was in a newspaper. She said, you know, that she was very ill, and she wanted the crown to find its original home. And my husband, without my knowing it, got in touch with her. She wouldn't take any money for it, and he got it. And my husband's he's in branding and marketing and design and all of this. So he had a glass dome.
Oh my God.
With a velvet little interior and a picture of me and the crown on top of that. And
did it look okay? Like, was it still in good shape?
Yes, it was in perfect condition. So it's so sweet. Yeah, so it's in my house.
That is, you know, and I remember watching that show. Why was that so indelible in people's minds? Was it because we didn't have that kind of fare on TV? It was like a very, very special thing? Or why is it that we always look back at that?
Yeah, I think it's because I really do think this way. You know, I didn't approach it like a fairy tale. It was very real to me at that time in my life. I really related to her as a girl who is unable to pursue her dreams and is relegated to being in her imagination all the time about it and not getting invited to the dance. And then all that ensues afterwards. And I think it was, I honestly think that it was so, young girls related so instinctively to how real it was for me, Leslie, that they fell in love with the whole project. Sometimes it's been done with satirical overtones, you know, or less imbued with reality.
Sure.
And I think that's why.
How was it doing it live?
It was, you know, fine. I mean, it was, you know, I come from the theater, so
you think millions are watching me?
I didn't think that.
Oh.
I didn't think that. You know, I only thought about the moment, the director, did he like what I was doing, making sure that I was able to manifest everything that I had hoped to manifest in each particular moment. Yeah.
When they brought it back then for Broadway, did you go?
Yes, they invited me to come and to surprise Kiki Palmer and come on stage and sing for the finale.
Oh, wow.
With the cast, which was wonderful.
But then did you say, wait a minute, now they changed the story.
Totally changed it.
And were you approving of that, or do you go?
Not so much. I felt like it was diminishing the purity and the innocence of the original fairy tale quality. And so for me, it was.
Yeah. No,
I didn't relate as much.
I can see that. And you can see why they did it, mm-hmm. you know? So there's a reason for everything.
Sure, of course.
During the Disney years, mm-hmm. did you meet Walt?
I did. He was the one who cast me in the first movie.
What do you remember of him?
He was wonderful. Absolutely wonderful to me. I mean, I've heard all kinds of stories, whatever. But with me, he was protective and like a granddad. You know, I was so young, and he was, he invited me and the other actors to his home, for dinners, and was on the set every day at different times, you know, and just supportive, just really supportive. And so I felt very taken care of.
Did you see him as this genius, though, that they regard him now? Or do you say, He's like a dad.
No, I saw him as a genius.
Yeah.
You know, he had an awareness, more than awareness. He had his finger in. He knew exactly what the animators were doing on a particular day. He knew what they were serving in the commissary. He knew what color ribbon I was wearing in my hair. I mean, he had his attention on every detail of everything that was going on in his world, in the studio, in his Disney universe.
Wow.
Yeah, so he was... I mean, it was thrilling to be in his
within it, you know, as a performer who's been touched by that,
mm-hmm.
and by touched by Blake.
Mm-hmm.
How do you accept or deal with people who are lesser than?
It ain't easy.
You know what I mean? Where it's like, well, no, I know how it should be.
It ain't easy. I'm telling you, it's tricky. You know, it's challenging and it's disappointing at times.
Yeah.
You know, I've also done projects with not such luminaries, but people who are so brilliantly talented, like Alan Rudolph, like Steven Soderbergh, you know, who is a genius in his world, you know, incredible artist, filmmaker. Maggie and Jake's father, Stephen Gyllenhaal, directed me in a miniseries. I mean, I've worked with some amazing, talented, brilliantly talented people that maybe didn't reach that stratosphere of Blake and Walt Disney and, you know, Richard Rodgers, you
sure.
know, but who were also exciting and, you know, artistically challenging to work with.
All right, Bruce, thanks for that interview. Sounds like another interesting topic from PBS.
Blake Edwards, A Love Story in 24 Frames, airs this next week on PBS, part of the American Masters series. So look for it because I think you'll enjoy it. And you see Bo Derek, she talks about things. Julie Andrews is in it. So it's an interesting way of maybe being introduced to Blake Edwards if you'd never really heard of him before.
So speaking of highbrow television and whatnot, you've seen Tiger King. Do you recall Tiger King?
Love Tiger King. That was one of my Halloween costumes one year.
Oh, man. So there's a sequel of sorts now on HBO. The first episode just dropped. I think it's maybe four episodes total. I got to look back and confirm. But it's the same director, Eric Good, who did Tiger King. He is doing a new kind of like documentary series, this time for HBO, called Chimp Crazy. And just, you know, if you think like, okay, Chimp Crazy, what could that be about? It's exactly what you think it is. It's a show about people who are raising chimpanzees or own them or are somehow involved with chimps. And it's sort of they have their own character, I guess. Like the first episode has this one woman who I guess we'll call her the Joe Exotic of Chimp Crazy. I think she refers to herself in the episode as the Dolly Parton of chimps.
Nice.
Yeah. So it's a little bit weird, but it kind of gets into, you know, like people that have chimps. It's a little disturbing. I mean, because you like,
she doesn't have a dead husband somewhere, does she?
No, but these are she speaks about chimps of like, I think early in the episode, it says something. She says something to the effect of like, you know, that bond you have with your children. Well, a bond you can have with a chimpanzee runs much deeper than that, which is no, like I love
really?
My cat. I love my cat, but like I love my kids more than my cat. Like
I think so.
I mean,
yeah,
it's a cat. I mean, I love my cat dearly. Don't get me wrong. Don't think I'm an awful cat person. Like I love my cat to death, but it's not my kids. Right? So they're not my human children. And so it's a little bit odd. And the other thing too, like you know, you see Tiger King, and they are just these tigers, right? They're just these giant, you know, vicious, ferocious type of
right.
cats.
They don't have personalities.
They don't, like chimps, like they show you right away the personalities that they have. They're very, I mean, they're so close to us in the evolutionary chain that, you know, we're only a few strands of DNA different from a chimp. You know, they're very intelligent. They have very similar lifespans to us. As we see in the episode, they like McDonald's. So, you know, they're just very similar in a lot of ways. So the the heartstrings that this tugs at, it runs a little bit deeper. Like I was maybe 5 minutes into this show and just I'm all immediately, you're killing me here, you know, that these poor animals have to live like this. And it gets into, so Eric Good, who does the show, because he's became known in animal circles for Tiger King, people don't want to really talk to him so much. So he basically got a proxy director who goes in his place to conduct interviews and try to set things up. And it's somebody who he was in the circus. He graduated from clown college. He had a bit of a run-in with the law because he, you know, had some exotic animals that the federal government said you should not have. So people in those type of circles kind of trust this guy and kind of, well, so they had, there's hidden cameras, there's interviews, there's all these different things. And it largely takes place kind of, you know, around St. Louis. So, you know, you kind of get to see the case. PETA gets involved and, you know, whatever your feelings are about PETA, because I mean, obviously some people feel very strongly about the good things that PETA does. There are some people that feel very strongly that their tactics are perhaps misguided, I guess it might be the way of putting it. But, you know, you kind of come away thinking like, yeah, I think PETA's got a case in this one.
Does it come to some conclusion at the end, or is it just kind of a slice of life thing?
Well, there's definitely a conclusion of sorts by the end of the first episode, but now I'm waiting for episode two next week. So it's not this isn't like a Netflix, like we're dumping all of the candy in the bowl for you to gobble up right away. This is, you've got to pace yourself and not gorge.
So then do you come back to that woman, or is her story told and then we move on to another story?
Oh no. There is definitely a cliffhanger at the end of episode one, I didn't realize that the show started this week. I was expecting one more episode and I was kind of angry that it didn't continue because it left me like craving more, you know.
You were chimp crazy.
I was chimp crazy. So this is the new Tiger King.
And how many episodes can I do it?
It sounds like four. So it's
I could do that.
Yeah. So we got the, you know, we did one in the can already, and then you got basically the rest of August, and there you go.
Good. It'll be a good back to school kind of thing.
Yeah, they're not, and it's not a long episode. It's like an hour or less.
And it doesn't cover like famous chimps where you go, oh.
Well, it does.
Oh, really?
Like, you'll know some of the, like, you've seen some of these chimps on greeting cards.
Really?
Like, in Pepsi commercials, in movies. Do you remember the actor Alan Cumming? He's been in a few films. He was
Traitor.
He's
the host of Traitor.
Yeah, and he was in Goldeneye as one of those early Pierce Brosnan.
Cabaret on Broadway won a Tony Award.
Yeah. He's involved with PETA, but he actually did a movie in the 90s with one of the chimps that's now in captivity, and he helped raise concern because he found out, like, he adored this chimp. Like, when he did this movie, the chimp would run up to him, give him a hug every day. They formed a bond on set. And then he kind of, like, I think he said it as, like, you know, they tell him, oh yeah, chimps, they just retired to Palm Springs. So when he got to California at some point, he's thinking, like, I'm going to California where there's like rich and famous and chimpanzees, which is not the case. So he kind of discovers what happened to this chimp that he had grown attached to, and the deplorable conditions, which they allege, and, you know, a judge kind of agreed with.
They don't live like the high life, and
no,
not at Neverland Ranch or anything like that.
Yeah, no, Alan Cumming is one of the protagonists in this. Working with PETA to help rescue these animals, basically. So yeah, there's some a lot of intrigue here.
Well, I gotta see it then. This will be one to watch.
Gotta watch it.
Yeah, but I only get like two episodes now, so I won't get them all.
Well, if you watch it this weekend, so you know we're kind of in between weeks, so we got one more coming up soon, and then you got two more weeks after that, and then that should be about it.
Sounds good. Sounds good.
I don't think we can go any further with this episode. We
can't get more.
No, we've gotten crazy enough with the chimps. So we'll end this episode. We thank you again for always coming back, and tune in again next week for another episode of Strange and Screened.